North Idaho News of the Week is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty, commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com. Good morning. It's Friday, May 10th, and you've tuned into North Idaho News of the Week. I'm Jack Peterson, and joined, as usual on Friday mornings, by Chris Bessler. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jack. How are you on this beautiful sunny morning?
It is a beautiful sunny morning, and I'm feeling rather sunny about it.
Yeah, good. And we have a beautiful sunny weekend coming up.
I know. Tell me about it.
Do you have the data right in front of you. Lay that on us before we get into the news.
Here you go. The high today is 80 degrees, low of 48 degrees tonight. Clear weather today, tomorrow, and Sunday. It looks like the highs tomorrow, 81, and on Sunday, Mother's Day, 81. And yes, clear, lows down into the 50s overnight. Even on Monday, cooling off to about 70 degrees and a 30% chance of showers, but still rather nice. Mm-hmm. Highs around 70 and a low chance of rain. Some chance of rain, but not, you know, doesn't look like it's going to rain all day. So beautiful weekend coming up and nice weather coming our way. We can talk about what else is going on in the natural environment too. But first, let's say good morning to award-winning journalist Zach Hagedon, who's joining us this morning. Thank you for being here from the Sandpoint Reader, the editor in chief.
Good morning.
Good morning, Zach.
Thank you for that introduction.
Yes, and we'll give you a chance
freshly awarded, you should say.
Yes, yeah. newly awarded
From the Idaho Press Club. Which they have an annual event, and they go through all the papers in the state, and they look at submissions from those papers to judge the quality of the journalism, and the Reader came with a bunch of awards there. Tell us about the awards you did land.
Oh, right there. Well, so as you were saying, Chris, the Idaho Press Club is our professional association for the state, so it's all the daily newspapers, all the weekly newspapers, the radio stations, the TV stations, everybody. They all gather once a year, and we submitted, I want to say, for 12 categories, including general excellence, and we won first place awards in 5 of those and placed second or third in the other 5. So we only got skunked on 2 awards. So 5 first places for myself, for staff writer Sansari Mitchell, and our former news editor Lindsay Kaber-Carey. We all got first places in various categories. And then we got seconds and thirds, including a second place for general excellence for all weekly publications in the state. So we felt pretty good about that.
Yeah. And the one that got first is the Boise Weekly, which, of course, serves a metro area many times the size of Sandpoint.
And my alma mater. So I don't. That's right. I was the editor-in-chief of the Boise Weekly at some point.
Yeah, you were there for several years.
I do have a little bit of pride for them winning.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes. And we can ask you actually more details about what you won for, but if time permits, let me do this first. The headlines today. First, in our natural environment, it's going to be a warm weekend, and it looks like it's going to be a warm spring. The Natural Resources Conservation Service Water Supply Outlook issued for May report states that the snowpack for North Idaho is well below normal. Thanks to some late snows in March, we got some snowstorms that kept us from being record level low snowpack, but it is well below normal, and that will lead to low water flows and higher than normal temperatures. The Idaho Department of Lands has announced that the closed burn season begins today, Friday, May 10th. That means any slash fires outside city limits require a permit, which you can find online and is easy to acquire. You can have a campfire, but you cannot have a uncontrolled, unmonitored fire anymore. And that will run through October, at least October. In the county, the Board of Commissioners appointed Quentin Duckin to the Fair Board, 2-1, with Commissioner Williams opposed to that appointment. And Zach wrote an article about that. We can get into those details. Here in the city, the downtown parking lot changes were discussed, including adding possible fees to the parking lot. That is the one located right in the center of downtown, which gets very busy during the summer. And the Gardenia Center is set to close and will be holding their final services this weekend. And then that lot will be sold. There is a Pike Derby coming up on the lake next Wednesday. Tickets available at Savory and Superfly Capital. Superfly Tackle in Kootenai. I mentioned that because next Wednesday is coming right up. And that is sponsored by the Lake Pend Oreille High School. Major coverage this week in the Reader of the Candidates Forum, which of course happened last week. And also that coverage in the Daily Bee continues. So both of our local papers have been talking about the election, the campaigns for the primary election. The campaign's currently underway. The election is on May 21st, and a lot of coverage of the races, particularly the contested Republican primaries, and we will be talking a little bit about that. Before we get into politics, can you tell us more about the county commissioners and the appointment of Quentin Duckin to the Fair Board, Zach?
Right. So this actually, Sansere wrote this piece. Sansere Mitchell covers all of our county meetings.
Apologies.
It's okay. So she's been keeping an eye on this for the past couple of weeks. And, you know, the Fair Board getting staffed up and getting properly sort of organized has been an ongoing issue, as we know, for years. So seeing a new member get appointed is, I guess, a good thing. It sort of points to seeking some stability, you know, with that body. However, nothing can happen in the county without at least a little bit of drama. So we have a very qualified person who wants to be on the Fair Board and is now. However, apparently they appointed that individual without doing any interviews. So Mr. Duckin, I guess his name is, was appointed based on his merit as opposed to interviews. There were other applicants too, I think three others, so a total of four. And Asia Williams, you know, Commissioner Williams took exception to that, saying like, hey, we should have probably sat down and talked to these people before we decided on one. And not that she opposes, you know, Duckin particularly. So she had nothing just bad to say about, you know, him as an individual. It was the process.
Yeah.
But, you know, Commissioner Ahmed, Commission Chair Luke Ahmed, kind of reiterated sort of Idaho code, saying like, look, the county commissioners are in charge of this thing. We can do it how we want to do it. So he and Commissioner Bradshaw voted as they usually do together, with Commissioner Williams dissenting. And so now we have a new member of the Fair Board over the objections of Commissioner Williams. And that's just sort of like the next chapter, I guess, is
in that. That seat's been vacant for something like 8 months, I think, if I read that story correctly, which means, I mean, so it has been out of compliance. They're supposed to appoint somebody right away, from what I understand.
Whenever they have those vacancies, it's on their heads to fill it as quickly as possible. So, but, you know, it's just kind of part and parcel with what's been happening with the Fair Board for, I think it's 2 years now.
How long is the term? Do you know how long the term is for that?
4 years.
It is 4 years. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So he's been appointed to a 4-year term, which will expire, I think, in May of 2028. It is kind of interesting that no interviews were held, considering that there were four applicants. He's
apparently very well known to the fair community. He's been a volunteer for a very long time, attends the meetings. So I don't think this is like some kind of dark horse, unknown individual who just got kind of ported into that position. I think that everyone was kind of in agreement that, he would be a good person to be on that body. But I think, again, the conflict, or if you want to call it a conflict, the disagreement maybe came down to like sort of a question of due diligence, maybe.
Yeah.
And optics, I'm sure, because everything that happens with the fair board becomes politically charged.
Yeah, the fair has been a source of conflict.
You're right.
For this entire last couple of years of commission business.
Well, sure. I don't think people would care, and people haven't cared about this for decades.
Yeah.
And the reason that people care about the process by which we get a new fair board member has to do with the ongoing issues regarding sort of financial transparency, financial reporting going forward. And there's a lot of people who have a lot of sort of political irons in the fire or dogs in the fight or whatever metaphor you want to use surrounding that issue. So who's on the board is going to be politically important to them in ways that it never has been before.
Yeah.
Considering how much energy gets expended related to, you know, auditing the fair's books, how far back we're going to go, et cetera, et cetera. And you have people who are running for office right now who, prior to launching their primary campaigns, made this one of their big signature issues. They would go to the county commissioner meetings and just hammer on this issue over and over again. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's the last we've heard of this, but, you know, at least we have some forward movement with getting people on the board.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Speaking of those campaigns, the first two plus pages, I think, of this week's Sandpoint Reader is dedicated to a breakdown of the forums of April 30, the forum of April 30th, which was the District 1 Senate and House candidates. And last week was dedicated to the breakdown of the April 29th forum, the county candidates. So,
we have expended a lot of ink on this.
Yeah, you've been...
between you know, here, KRFY, between KRFY, Sandpoint Online, us, and the B, if people in the community are not aware that there is a primary election on May 21st...
And they've had a lot of opportunities to get informed about who the candidates are, too.
Right.
By so, all these various media here.
If we had been able to cram all of these into one paper, we would have, but you people would have been reading at least four pages of forum recap. So we decided to break it up into two sections.
Well, I think that was the right move.
I think so.
And, it's a good encapsulation of the forum, but I will mention that if you want to actually go ahead and hear the whole forum, you got two hours to spare. You can go to kfy.org because we have recordings of the of that forum as well as the county forum that was held the previous night.
That is correct. Yes, right there on the front page, you can find links to those audio files. Before we kind of break down the forum, this is a campaign season that I would say it's nice that all the candidates have been very forthcoming and open and responding to the requests from the media for comment and things like that. But also it kind of happens, because it's a primary, it seems like it kind of happens behind closed doors a lot of the time. There was the forum that was public facing and we covered, but I'm sort of wondering what's been happening for the last 2 weeks since the forum happened. Week and a half since we actually had those forums. You know, the candidates are out there doing what? Where are they going? How are they conducting their campaigns? Would you guess, or do you know?
Well, I mean, I know for certain that they're fundraising.
Yeah.
You look at, and this is something I was going to report on for next week, so there's a little sneak peek, but I always like to kind of go back and look at the campaign finance disclosures as we get closer to the actual day. And I was looking at our Senate 1, you know, District 1 race between Scott Herndon and Jim Woodward, which is, of course, the most interesting and closely watched race in the entire state.
Yeah.
You talk to anybody down in Boise, as I did when we were down there for the Press Club Awards. Everyone was just like, oh, my gosh, we're so glad that somebody from North Idaho's here, because we all want to know what's going on with your Senate race.
Mm-hmm.
So the energy in Boise, even around that race, is extreme. And you dig into the amount of money that Herndon and Woodward have raised has been like historic for a primary, for really any election at the state legislative level.
Mm-hmm.
Last I looked 2 days ago, Woodward had upwards of $113,000 in his sort of campaign fund, which was placed him first in the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
And Herndon had a little over 100,000, which made him third. So our District 1 Senate race collectively, you know, has has more money than almost everybody in the whole rest of the legislative races. Only Steve Birch was in second place, and he's a Democrat from District 15 down in Boise. And he's got two Democratic challengers, so he's in second place for fundraising. But really, it's Jim and Scott are the big ticket items statewide.
Yeah, and it has to go with the way it's going to affect the balance of power in the legislature between. I mean, they're both Republicans, but they have, I guess, they're following somewhat different ideologies.
Well, I mean, you got Herndon being sort of the firebrand standard bearer for the Freedom Caucus. Which is that sort of contingent within the Republican caucus that prides itself on being particularly hardline ideologically. Dorothy Moon, being the chair of the Idaho Republican Party, is certainly would have been a member of the Freedom Caucus if she was still in the state house. So calling them sort of fringe or outside the mainstream of the Republican Party in Idaho is probably not true, considering the fact that the leadership of the party agrees with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Herndon's kind of contingent, whereas Woodward, I think everyone agrees, from state politics watchers in Boise all the way to, you know, people here in the community, would agree that he's much more of a kind of traditional establishment, quote unquote, Republican, what you might expect to have seen from the Republican Party 20 years ago, kind of, focused more on infrastructure, jobs, kind of the meat and potatoes, nuts and bolts kind of functioning of the state. Looking at keeping costs down, but still providing services, still believing, you know, that government has a legitimate function in a lot of these areas, like education, protecting natural resources. Whereas you look at the Freedom Caucus generally, much more focused on kind of the hot button social issues of the day, you know, talking about sort of transgender health care, women's reproductive rights, you know, with a staunch anti-abortion stance. Lots of things about like sort of indoctrination bugaboos, whether it be in school, with curriculum stuff, you know, talking about critical race theory, quote unquote, or talking about school libraries with, you know, material that's considered to be harmful to minors or obscene. These are the kinds of things that the Freedom Caucus group really hammers at. And that's not really Woodward's perspective. He doesn't feel like those are things that he necessarily wants to wade into. And you saw that at the forum. Where, you know, some of the questions submitted by the audience keyed into those issues. And over again, you know, Herndon would go back to sort of saying the Idaho Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, and Scripture, meaning, you know, sort of religious guidance, determines his stance on these things. And he feels like they're all very principled based on those ideas. Whereas Woodward would say something like, you know, specifically regarding the library bill, House Bill 710, which gives sort of a pathway for people to sue libraries if they feel like their kids are being exposed to things they don't like, that are obscene or harmful in some way. Woodward would say that's not legitimate use of state power. That's a local issue. You got a problem with something in the library, go to your library, talk to the librarians there. They have policies in place already. We don't need to turn this into a state policy area that has, you know, sort of legal ramifications with lawsuits. And, you know, you have other people running for office that agreed with that. Chuck Lohman was running for, was it House Seat 1A?
B.
Yeah. Yep. Sorry. There's so many candidates.
The seat that Sage Dixon.
Yeah, that's right. 1B. Yep. So Chuck Lohman agreed with that perspective as well from a slightly different angle, saying like, look, if we throw libraries under the bus in this way and expose them to legal challenges based on people's more or less subjective feelings about material in the library, they could very well go after the Bible. There's passages in the Bible that people have challenged as harmful and obscene or offensive in some way. And Lohman, who expresses himself as a person of deep faith, says, well, I don't want to see the day when insurance companies are in the driver's seat advising libraries what they should or shouldn't have in their collections. And if it's deemed too risky in a community to have something like the Bible on the shelves, then insurance companies might be like, well, sorry, you probably shouldn't have that in your collection. So there's a couple of different angles at which people can approach these issues. And it was interesting to see where people kind of came down on that particular question, because it has been such a big political talking point in Boise and up here as well, even though it doesn't really have a lot of bearing on the day-to-day functioning of the state government. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not roads, it's not schools, it's not natural resources. You know, it's this kind of social, ideological argument.
Cultural issues.
Culture war stuff, yeah. Hmm.
You mentioned the name Sage Dixon, who's vacating the seat, House 1B. What's his future hold?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Were you surprised that he decided not to run for re-election?
I don't know that I was super surprised. No. I was a little surprised that he didn't have something else in politics that he was going to do. There was rumors all over the place that he was going to run for county commissioner or something like that. That kind of surprised me more. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd been in the House for
10 or 12 years.
Yeah, a long time.
It's his fifth term, and he is the assistant majority leader as well. So, yeah, he seemed to be sort of a rising star. He's only 54, could have certainly held the seat.
I think, found himself caught in between those two factions.
That was my sense, too. Yeah. Politically, he had a hard row to hoe. Mm-hmm. Because before it was cool, mm-hmm. you know, to be really outspoken about these really conservative social issues, he was kind of a voice that really brought his, you know, faith into his decision making. You know, he was really a voice on sort of like abortion issues, stuff like that. But I don't think he was prepared to approach politics in the way the Freedom Caucus does across the board. I think he had very specific issues that he cared about deeply from kind of a cultural, social perspective. But by and large, he was a lot more kind of like the establishment sort of mainline Republicans, where he was willing to fund schools, you know, and willing to look at infrastructure and kind of go along with sort of the broader trajectory of status quo state governance. So I think you're exactly right, Chris, that he was kind of in the middle of all that. And I don't know that he necessarily had a super confrontational attitude, which you sort of need to have if you're going to be one of these folks. Like, you know, Herndon, he's not afraid to get down and dirty and jab at people. And Heather Scott, who's a part of that group, she obviously is able to be very aggressive with people. And Dorothy Moon isn't afraid to say what she wants to say. So Sage has always been much less of that kind of flamethrower type person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was chair of the ethics committee.
Yes, right.
Yeah, and he caught a lot of heat there. And what was the particular case that came up?
That was the Priscilla Gittings.
Yes.
This was a really difficult position for him to be in, because Priscilla Gittings was one of the anointed of the Freedom Caucus. She was definitely seen as a rising star. She's from, like, I think, White Bird area. Mm-hmm. She was running for lieutenant governor. And everyone was very excited from that wing of the party that they were going to potentially have Janice McGeehan as the governor and Priscilla Gittings as lieutenant governor. But Gittings got wrapped up in this really kind of grotesque case where one of the former lawmakers from her area, from like Lewiston area, Von Ellinger, I forget his first name.
Yeah. But he was actually convicted.
He was a convicted rape of a 19-year-old legislative staffer.
Staffer, an intern.
Very young person. Well, she came to his defense, you know, pretty vocally, as did a lot of other folks from the Freedom Caucus side. And then there was a Reed Hout News article that was posted online that sort of like gave away this person's identity. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, known as doxing, I guess, in some circles. And
the victim's identity.
The victim's identity, which is very closely guarded in cases like this. I mean, the media doesn't report people's names when they're in a case of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. So it was seen as very irresponsible, of course, but on the part of the website. But then Priscilla Gittings retweeted it or reposted it or disseminated it in some way. And that was seen as incredibly irresponsible and unbecoming of a lawmaker. And she was sort of trying to use it in the context of her campaign, I guess, to sort of rally the troops. And it was, like I say, it was a grotesque situation. So she got hauled up on ethics charges, which is very unusual. The party does not tend to do that to its own. And so here you had this very high profile lawmaker who's in a very high profile candidacy for lieutenant governor, all of a sudden having to go through an ethics process, and then Sage Dixon had to be the chair.
He was the chair of that, yeah. And he conducted it with integrity. Even though he was getting a lot of heat.
And she was ultimately censured.
Yeah.
And he had to make that call, and I think he didn't necessarily relish that role and probably didn't want
to. That was a tough role for any. It would have been tough for anybody to be in. Mm-hmm. So, but swinging back to the upcoming election. So that is for House Seat B, and actually Chuck Lohman is going to be facing off against Cornell Razor. Mm-hmm. What did you glean out of the forum on those two candidates?
They had a pretty stark difference in their view on sort of federal lands. That was an interesting theme that ran through the House comments during that forum, mm-hmm. especially the House, with a lot of the candidates expressing this idea that we're going to somehow take back, quote unquote, federal lands and turn them into state lands. And then that's going to be this huge financial windfall and save us from property taxes and make us rich and all this kind of thing. People have been saying this for a long time.
That's a stretch.
It's a very large stretch. And I mean, I've talked about this in the context of like that Timber Wars series I did back in the day, where this is a long time sort of very conservative right wing, almost John Birchy sort of thing to say that we're going to take back these lands. Well, we never actually had them to begin with. And you would need to go through some pretty serious hoops to make this happen. And Cornell Razor, of course, is sort of the Idaho Republican Party's chief constitutionalist. He's renowned throughout the state party for knowing the Constitution inside and out and being able to quote from it, you know, out of his vast well of knowledge. So he made a lot of like very detailed arguments about how we're going to do this, take back federal lands. Chuck Lohman says, well, no, we're not going to do that. And we can't really do it. And even if we could, he cited some situations elsewhere in the country where even if we did do that, it would not be good for us. It would end up with, you know, billionaires, millionaires, whatever, corporations buying up all that land. And then, you know, we wouldn't have access to it. It wouldn't do us any good. It would do these private parties a lot of good. So there's no resolution to that argument. You know, it's just that it's just the two sides.
Right.
And it was interesting to see those two kind of be in such direct opposition about that particular point.
And they were very respectful of each other. I'll say in that race, those two opponents were respectful. Now, in House Seat B, there is actually a contested Democratic race as well. And Catherine Larson came and spoke at the forum. Her opponent, Bob Vicarious, who lives in Bonners Ferry, I don't think he got back to anybody about yay or nay.
He's almost a perennial candidate at this point. He's put his name on the ballot several times, and we know that he's not actually a Democrat.
If there's rhinos, he's a dino, right?
He's a very well-known John Birch activist. He's a very, very right-wing individual, and it's funny that the whole rhino thing is such a big talking point in this race, with Republicans accusing each other left, right, and center, or maybe just all right, of being fake Republicans. Well, the only person in the race that we know, without a doubt, is sort of masquerading as another party is a guy who's pretending to be a Democrat. So you can say what you will about rhinos. As far as I know, none of these people have ever been registered as Democrats.
We actually had Bob in for an interview. Susie interviewed him as part of our series, and you can hear that if you go to our website, KRFY.org, and listen to both Catherine and Bob Vicarious. We're going to run out of time, but let's touch base on the House seat, Representative A seat, which is Spencer Hutchings, Jane Souter, and the incumbent Mark Souter are contesting for the Republican nomination there. Was there any talk about that down in Boise? Could Mark, being an incumbent, of course, this hasn't got the attention that the Senate race has gotten.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't come up in conversation down there, but I think up here, that race is interesting for a couple of reasons. One, you know, is that Spencer Hutchings is very well known for sort of his internal Republican Party politics. I mean, he was the treasurer, I believe, of the Central Committee, but then he was sort of voted out of that job. He's had a couple of high-profile incidents, you know, public anger. He and Commissioner Bradshaw do not like each other and had a very sort of profanity-laced interaction in the parking lot of the commissioner building. Hutchings shows up to a lot of commissioner meetings and is very aggressive toward Amit and Bradshaw both. So, I mean, he's very in-your-face kind of candidate, and people know that both within the party and without the party. Jane Souter is a little bit unknown, I think, to most people, and it's so interesting that she has the exact same last name as the incumbent.
Yes. They're not related.
No, they're not. There's no relation whatsoever there. And, you know, she's coming to this sort of admitting that she doesn't really know a lot of the details about policy and why things are happening the way they're happening. She's really running as a, you know, sort of conservative Christian I mean, she talks about how she has a lot of kids, so mm-hmm. she's a family values kind of thing. And then Mark is, again, sort of in the same vein as Woodward. You know, Souter is very much an establishment kind of traditional Republican from mm-hmm. Idaho who's mm-hmm. really keyed in on stuff like roads and jobs and mm-hmm. education funding. And, you know, he's been a pretty consistent vote, you know, for his own conscience. He's voted against a lot of things that the Republican Party has wanted him to vote against or vote for. So he's not afraid of sort of expressing himself and holding to his guns, and he doesn't make any apologies about it. And I think that wins him a lot of support from folks up here. That race, I don't know, is going to be as close as the Senate one.
Well, it's going to be, there's three candidates, so it's mm-hmm, going to split yeah. the vote in ways that are a little hard mm-hmm. to predict here. Whereas in the Senate race, it's, you know, kind of a...
Yeah. I think Souter's seen as more safe, perhaps, mm-hmm. by the political watchers. Mm-hmm.
And in part because the vote is going to be split.
Right.
Yeah.
The 1B race, it's anybody's guess. I mean, we don't really know who's going to come out on top there, because not having Sage Dixon in that race, it's kind of anybody's.
Mm-hmm. Right. Open seat. Yeah. But that one will be contested, though. Well, both of these will be contested in the general election.
There'll be Democrats.
Yeah, there will be Democrats. Mm-hmm. Karen Mathey is running for seat A. And she'll be on the general election ballot.
Well, and that's a state trend, too. More Democrats mm-hmm. on the ballot this time around statewide than mm-hmm. at any time in the recent past. I think mm-hmm. it's double the number of Democrats are running mm-hmm. in this primary than mm-hmm. usually do. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting, too, that there's a sense that the Democratic Party is trying to make a comeback. Mm-hmm. And these are serious candidates. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had Democrats on the ballot before who were just there as placeholders. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But these are actual candidates with actual policy ideas, and they really do want to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Steve Johnson is announced again as an independent candidate in Senate District 1, which is the Herndon-Woodward race. So he'll be facing he ran a write-in campaign and got, I think, more than 40% of the vote.
It was historically good write-in.
Right. Against Herndon last time. So if...
Dan Rose has filed as an independent. So
yep.
Dan, Steve, and whoever wins between Scott and Jim will be on that right. general election ballot.
Right. We didn't even mention the sheriff's race, and it probably probably we don't have time to even start talking about it.
We don't. That's one of the county races. We kind of touched on that last week. And I will say we had interviews with both the sheriff candidates on Wednesday, and mm-hmm. There are some interesting differences there.
Right.
Well. Yeah. So you can go to our website, KRFY.org, and hear the individual interviews we had with Daryl Wheeler and Steve Bradshaw.
Yes. And coming up, a little programming note here, coming up next week, tune in on Monday when we'll be airing interviews with the aforementioned Scott Herndon and Jim Woodward. And then on Wednesday, who do you have for Wednesday?
We're doing the seat A candidate, so we're gonna have interviews with Spencer Hutchings, Jane Souter, and Mark Souter.
Okay,
and that'll wrap up our local decision series of interviews with individual candidates.
Right, because the following week, on Tuesday, May 21st, will be
Should mention that early voting is happening right now. So mm-hmm, election day is May 21st, but you can vote anytime during business hours up until the 17th at the county election office in the county building on Highway 2.
Mm-hmm. Zach, before we go, do you want to take another victory lap on your many awards that you collected from the Idaho Press Club? Any one of them that you're particularly proud of?
I was very proud of Lindsay Kaber-Carey for getting first place in election coverage. That's always a hard one mm-hmm. for us to crack. That was really cool. I was very proud of Sansa Ray Mitchell for getting her very first ever first place plaque. Mm-hmm. And she has not even worked for the paper for a year. She has not even been a journalist for a full year.
Uh-huh.
And she has already won a first place award at the press club, which says a lot. It took me until I was probably in my 30s before I got a first place plaque at the press club. So she's definitely ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. And I bizarrely have won a first place for editorial and or opinion writing every year for the past 4 years, which I guess makes me now a columnist more than a journalist.
Yeah.
So my opinions apparently do better than my reporting.
What? You have opinions?
Who knew? So, yeah. No, it was good. So I'm very proud of the staff, and I thank the readers and people who care about what we do. Just I hope we're doing you proud. We hope.
Well, on that note,
I'm going to throw out one more little thing of note. Yes. Go out late tonight and look up in the sky. We might see some big displays of the Northern Lights, because there's been what they call a coronal mass ejection from the sun, a big one. They're calling it the Cannibal CME. And because there's been a number of them that combined. And so there's a pretty good chance that there will be Northern Lights up there. Got to look up pretty late, though, probably after midnight.
Well, okay. It's the weekend. We can stay up late. That's fine.
That's right.
All right. We'll check out the Northern Lights tonight. A reminder, the fire ban is now in effect. You need a permit. And on that note, we'll go out with a little Lord Huron with She Lit a Fire. Thanks again, Zach. Editor of the Sandpoint Reader, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long here on 88.5 KRFY.